Hello and welcome to another episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. It's been a while since I recorded the last episode. I've been busy studying an advanced course in Mandarin at a university in Taiwan. But we're back now and planning regular episodes over the coming weeks and months. So on today's episode, we speak to Pamela Rose, an educator and Mandarin teacher with a fascinating background. So Pamela grew up in New York to a Chinese mother and an American father. She didn't learn any Chinese in early childhood, but as a teenager became fascinated by the language as well as her own cultural heritage. From there, she embarked on a journey which would culminate in her not only becoming fluent in Chinese, but also qualifying as a Mandarin teacher. Pamela's teaching style is largely inspired by Stephen Krashen's comprehensible input, which we've discussed a lot on this podcast before, as well as a method called TPRS, which stands for Teaching Proficiency Through Reading and Storytelling. In this podcast, Pamela shares her story with us and explains how her experiences in the classroom, both as an instructor and a learner, have shaped her teaching approach and methods. Before we proceed to today's episode, a quick word from our partner, Mandarin Retreat. Mandarin Retreat are an organisation based in the UK that organise immersive Chinese learning weekend trips and extended camps. Chinese tutors and native Chinese speakers are brought together with Mandarin learners of all levels for retreats packed full of fun cultural activities, all delivered 100% in Mandarin Chinese. On previous trips, retreaters were treated to lessons in making Chinese dumplings, calligraphy, as well as Tai Chi. If you're based in Europe and are looking for opportunities to immerse in Chinese for extended periods, you might want to check out their summer camp, which will take place from August the 28th to September the 1st in Wales. All food and accommodation is included, and anyone who books on a retreat will get 5 online Chinese classes with the private language school LTL Mandarin as part of the package. All levels will be fully supported by a team of volunteers and Mandarin tutors. For more details, check out mandarinretreat.com, and I'll include a link to that in the description. Now on to today's episode. Okay, so Pamela, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, 你好.
So you've been studying Chinese for a long time now, and also teaching Chinese as well. I just wondered if you could take us back to how you got into Chinese. My understanding is that you grew up with some Chinese around you. Can you tell us a bit more about your background?
Sure. So I have a mom who was born in China and raised in Taiwan. And when she came to the United States, she met my dad here in New York City. And she, I think, originally wanted to teach me Mandarin. And, you know, this is like late 70s, early 80s. So the idea of bilingualism for children didn't have a stronghold as it does now. I mean, I see now as an educator, everybody wants to have their child to speak not just one or two, but 3 or 4 languages by the time that they're, you know, 6. I'm like, hold your horses, people. It's okay. But back then it was about assimilating into American society. And so she, unfortunately, didn't really get to teach me Mandarin growing up. My father's family was kind of all about assimilating into American society. And so my dad, who actually had his parents spoke Yiddish, they were from Jewish households, and he didn't grow up speaking it either. My grandparents very much, my paternal grandparents wanted to be Americans. So it was around me. By the time I was, I'd say 5 or 6, both my paternal grandparents had passed away. And so I was spending time going with my mom to my Chinese grandmother, my popo, in Queens. So it was around me. I heard it. There were certain words I think I knew, particularly food words, which I think is very common for people who have immigrant parents. So it was around me, and I didn't really quite understand what Chinese was linguistically or culturally until I was about 10 or 11. And then I think it hit me that, oh, wait, this is a whole different culture. This is a different language. This is like something different. It made me realize I wanted to learn more about it, about the language. And I was kind of begging my mom to send me to Chinese school because I knew there were these weekend schools. There was no Mandarin taught in elementary, middle school, or high school. Not in my area, not in the schools that I went to. Unfortunately, I went to a Hebrew school, obviously, as a Jewish kid, and Hebrew school and that weekend Mandarin school were at the same time. So until I got my bat mitzvah and was sort of out of Hebrew school, I could finally, at that point, finally take Mandarin at the weekend school. And so I started taking it at 15. But obviously, I didn't have much of a language background, so they put me with the first graders. So here I was, 15 years old, with a bunch of first grade kids, but I had begged for years to go to this school, and I got something out of it. I definitely learned a little bit. And then I went to Taiwan for a summer between my junior and senior year of high school. Something that's called Love Boat, Jiantan. So Love Boat is the moniker given by the kids who went to it. There was no boat involved. You can see a documentary. There's a couple documentaries and actually a movie that's going to be produced by a big studio based on this program for overseas Chinese kids. And so I went on that, and that had a language component. So I was little by little picking up Mandarin. And then when I decided to look for and figure out what colleges I wanted to apply to, I only looked at schools that had Mandarin programs. And I ended up at the University of Chicago, which at that time in the late 90s had, from what I could understand, one of the best Mandarin language programs in the country, with a professor named Zhao Zhichao, whose English name I think is George Chow. And I had heard he was tough, but that you learned it and you learned it well. And it was my first real formal training in Mandarin. It was intense. He's given a lot of criticism for how tough he could be, and he was, and his system was really rigorous. It was like military training, boot camp. You had to be there at, like, it was either 8 or 8:30 in the morning. So as a college student, to get up and walk across campus to go to this, you know, class every single day. It was Monday to Friday for the first, I think, two quarters. And you had to go to language lab for at least an hour a day. And if you did go to language lab, he knew, because he would look at the attendance sheet. And if you didn't go for like twice in 1 week, the next week he would walk into class and he'd be like, Pamela, why didn't you go to language lab on Monday and Wednesday? And you'd, of course, like, be stumbling, trying to give it an excuse. And he'd be like, you have to practice. Otherwise, you will not get better. And he was just very grave in the way he spoke. But I think he did it not just to scare us, but to really motivate us. It was tough, but I give him a lot of credit, because even though I may not have acquired a lot of actual useful language per se to be able to speak, I think it gave me a foundation in tones and pronunciation that I take with me to this day.
You said that when you were growing up with Chinese around you, at that point you didn't really speak any Chinese, but do you think that later on, when you went through this rigorous program at university in Chinese studies, did that, having that background, help you, did it give you an advantage over your peers?
At first I don't think it did, but then I think something clicked. Something clicked at some point. I remember thinking to myself, oh, this sounds familiar. It did click after a while, but it took a bit. It took a bit of time, and I suspect that's input. I've had moments over the years in my own language learning journey where I was like, oh, this sounds really familiar. And I connect it probably with something that I heard in growing up. It was definitely helped, and I definitely think there's a connection, but I don't think that connection is as strong as I would have liked it to be.
That makes sense. You mentioned input, and that's something that I wanted to cover with you today. Basically, your experiences that you've just described and the studies that you did at university, thanks to them, you started to develop an interest in Chinese as a language and also how Chinese is taught. So when did that kind of interest in teaching Chinese, which you later went on to do, when did that kind of transpire or emerge?
Yeah, teaching Mandarin didn't come until much later. Sort of like a short primer on my background. I ended up, because of my interest in Mandarin, did a double concentration in East Asian studies and art history, basically Chinese art history. And I thought I was going to be a Chinese art historian. And I actually even worked at a major art museum in their Asian art department and realized that I did not want to be a curator. And when I went to do my master's in East Asian studies at Columbia, thinking I'd, you know, maybe do academia, realized I didn't really want to do academia either. I knew that I wanted to teach K to 12, even in that Columbia program. I didn't realize that I could teach language. I don't think it even dawned on me that I could be a Mandarin teacher. I was just maybe insecure about my own language learning experience. My ability to speak, it was proficient when I was at Columbia, probably 2 or 3 years after college. I had worked in between at that museum. And I realized I really needed to work on my Mandarin regardless of whatever I did. I wanted to be fluent. I really wanted a certain level of fluency. And so I applied for a language scholarship in Taiwan that the government gives. I went back to the language school that I had gone to both in college for a summer and for the summer in between my first and second year at Columbia in my master's program. And it's called ICLP, International Chinese Language Program at Taida. I had only done summers, but this was the year-long program. And so I went, and about 3 weeks in, I happened to connect with an old friend from Gentan, the love boat program I had met many years ago. And he introduced me to his then girlfriend. She was this Italian woman. And I looked at her, I said, "What are you doing here in Taiwan?" And she says, "Oh, I'm getting a master's in teaching Chinese as a second language." And I looked at her and I was just like, "But you're not Chinese. How can you do that?" And she said, "No, the program actually really welcomes foreign students. And it's really important for them to make connections with institutions and teachers around the world." I think at that moment, that was my light bulb moment in my life. It was like, oh, this is what I'm meant to do. This is what drives me. Is I had that inkling as a child, as a 10 or 11 year old child, of I want to learn this language. And it was coming full circle for me of what I wanted to do with it. I loved it so much and I loved my own journey that I wanted to share that with future students.
Did you have a well-formed idea at that time when you kind of say you had that light bulb moment? At that point, did you have a reasonably well-formed idea of the kind of Chinese teacher you'd like to be or the kind of methods you'd like to use, or did that come later?
No, not at all. I mean, I knew what I didn't like in terms of classes that I had taken to that point, because by then I probably had 20 or 30 Mandarin teachers because I had done summer programs. I'd done Princeton and Beijing in college. I'd done ICLP twice at that point. So I had already had 10 or 20 Mandarin teachers. So I knew what worked and what didn't work, but I didn't know what that meant going forward as a teacher. I had to figure that out. And I also realized at that point too, that if I was going to teach or going to get this master's in teaching and eventually become a Mandarin teacher, I needed experience teaching languages. So while I was applying to this program that year, I was at ICLP for the year, and the ICLP teachers, many of whom had done that master's program, Taiwan Shifen Dashui, Huayinso was what it was called at the time. Those Chinese teachers, many of them were my shuejie, they had actually come out of that program themselves. So they helped me with applying to the program, applying for the scholarship that the Taiwanese government has for master's programs. And I ended up getting both. And I was very excited. At that point, at the same time as I was applying to this program, I was like, oh man, I need to have some practice and actually teach languages. So I started to teach a little bit of English on the side in Taiwan, tutoring, and then I had some classes, adult classes. And that actually, I realize now, helped inform a lot of my choices that I made later on as a teacher, because I realized what worked and what didn't work. It was a very practical way to go about that prior to going into a real classroom in the United States and to teach Mandarin. They don't tell you in the master's program how long it takes you to get out of it. that was not a two-year program because everything was in Mandarin. So my Mandarin was quite good. My Chinese reading ability was quite good coming out of ICLP, but I wasn't like a native, right? And here I was thrown into classes that were completely in Mandarin. The readings, half of them were in Chinese. My essays and my tests were all in Chinese. And my thesis ended up being 140 pages in Chinese. And it was a research thesis. And that took me almost 6 years, about 5.5 years to complete. And so my scholarship actually only lasted 2 years. So all of the teaching that I did, ESL teaching, I eventually became a part-time master's student and full-time English teacher while I was in Taiwan for the last couple of years. And that, I think, was, at the time, it was because I had to do it that way. I realized looking back, it was really informative for my teaching going forward as a Mandarin teacher.
You said that the course that you were doing was very welcoming of non-native Chinese speakers training to teach as Chinese as a foreign language. How did you find then when you transitioned to becoming a teacher, how did you find you were received by students and parents of students in general in that teaching Chinese as a foreign language world industry?
Well, I think it's different. There's a difference between the actual schools that I taught at versus the Chinese teaching community in the United States. And by that, I mean the conferences I went to, the workshops I did, the trainings I did, the associations that I belong to, and I still belong to some of them. I was very much welcomed at the schools that I taught at. I think part of the reason for that was that I was born and raised here in the United States, and a lot of the programs, and we're talking about K-12, we're not talking about adult university level jobs, but for a long time, probably from the 2000s through the 2010s, Mandarin was the hot language, and it was the one that schools wanted to provide for the students, particularly private schools, to a lesser degree, public schools, but both. And so it was growing and growing and growing. But the problem with it all was that there weren't really enough teachers, qualified teachers, people who were or had experience teaching. So you had a lot of these teachers who were basically retired, semi-retired from other industries. A lot of times I've come across so many teachers who are like, yeah, I have a master's in engineering. And I'm like, are you teaching language? And the only qualification they really had was that they were a native speaker and their kids grew up in the US, right? Not themselves, but the kids. So there was that's a huge difference in the Chinese teachers that were here in the United States versus the schools themselves. So when I went to my first school, they had had actually a Mandarin teacher who was a Western woman who had taught, I guess she had learned Mandarin herself over the course of college and grad school. She started their program. So when I walked in, not being a native speaker, not being fully Chinese, it was not an issue. I was welcomed. And the same goes for the second school I was in. They actually had it even worse. They had gone through, I think, 5 teachers in 7 years. And part of the issue was dealing with a lot of the cultural clash between the native speaking teacher and the Western American students. Did a lot of presentations over the years, over those years teaching in the classroom. I participated and attended quite a number of regional and national conferences. And I was welcomed, but I also felt like there was a wall between myself and native speaking teachers. And I think that wall was partly cultural, partly age. A lot of these teachers that I would come across were much older than me. And of course, there is the cultural understanding or cultural tradition, you want to call it, of respecting your elders within the Asian societies and Asian communities. I came across this actually at my second school. I had a co-teacher. She taught the lower school and I taught 5th to 8th grade. I think at the beginning, there was a bit of a clash because I think she thought she could teach me. And it wasn't more about collaborating. It was more about, I'm the older person here. This is what I'm going to tell you. This is the advice I'm giving you. And she also was similar in that she did not come from a teaching background. She had done, I don't think it was engineering, but it was something not education related. And so, but after 3 years, actually, we learned from each other. We definitely did learn from each other. And it was actually a very good experience. And when I was stepping away from the position and left the school, we had a really great conversation about our time together. But when it came to these associations, you know, I worked with this teacher for 3 years. We got to know each other. And I think, you know, that time spent together and we were in actually the same room for a while helped. But in a lot of these associations, these conferences that the associations had, I'd meet these people for a couple minutes, sometimes maybe an hour. And so they didn't really get to know me and I didn't really get to know them. Through the online channels, Facebook, Twitter, and email, quite frankly, I've gotten to know more of them more deeply about how they teach, what they do. And they've gotten to know a little bit more about me and my experience. I think that has helped. But there's definitely, within the Mandarin teaching community, I think there's an element from the native speaking teachers and the non-native speaking teachers. There's definitely a schism of some sort. It's unspoken. I think the ideal department, the ideal situation is a non-native speaking teacher and a native speaking teacher working hand in hand. My experience with that was so positive, and I recommend it 100%. Unfortunately, especially in the university level, you just don't have that.
Yeah, I think that combination is particularly fruitful because there's obvious advantages to both. I mean, the kinds of insights that you have as somebody who's had to learn the language from scratch in adulthood is going to be different to if you're a native speaker teaching the language.
One of the things that I see that's very difficult in the K-12 sort of field is that a lot of native speaking teachers, they didn't grow up going to elementary, middle school, or high school in the United States or in a Western society. And there is a cultural clash, you could say, because in Asian societies, in the schools I've seen, students sit there and they listen. They don't ask questions. This is very typical in the Taiwanese Chinese classroom and in Japan and Korea. But in the Western classroom, particularly in the United States, we learn from the time we're very young that we should speak up and ask questions. And we should speak up and we can be rowdy. As somebody who taught middle school for a number of years in the United States, I will tell you that students can be rowdy. So classroom management and understanding your students from that cultural, pop culture perspective is really important. So a lot of these teachers, especially if they're older, they may not have as much of a ear to pop culture of what's going on at the moment with their students, and it's harder for them to connect. They don't have the references, and that can create kind of a wall and a challenge for those teachers. And then I know that this has been a frustration with a lot of the schools that they can't find a teacher who can connect. Because at the end of the day, I think this happens even at the university level, maybe to a lesser extent, because there's more self-motivation for those students. But in the K-12 field, those students aren't necessarily making the choice to be in that classroom. They A, have to take a language, but B, it may be a family member or other reasons why they're taking that class, taking Mandarin. And if you as a teacher, and again, this is the basis, I think, of all relationships and the basis of language, you have to be able to connect to your students. They need to be able to be felt seen and heard and understood. And when I say understood, not necessarily from a linguistic perspective, but who they are as people. I think when a teacher does that, even if the student is not acquiring language at the pace that they'd like to see, that student, you've got buy-in from the student. And I think that's what's hard for sometimes for native speaking teachers is that they don't know how to make that connection, how to get deeper into making their students feel seen and heard and understood. The biggest compliment I ever got from a student was a student who had a twinkle in his eye. Let's put it that way. You know, he was that student who would kind of speak out. And he didn't speak out in a mean, bullying kind of way. He just wanted to participate. And one day when he was just really going at it, I took him aside after class. I was like, hey, buddy, what's going on? Like, why, you know, you keep interrupting class and I know you want to say something, but we've got to take turns and, you know, wait until you're called. And he just looked at me. He goes, Zhang Lao Shi, you know, in your class, I just feel like I can be me. And I took that as one of the biggest compliments because he felt comfortable. He felt like I understood him. I heard him. I saw him. And I think that really made me realize what the most important thing in a classroom, regardless of anything you teach, is about. Now, once you get that buy-in from students, that's when the actual teaching comes into play.
Your teaching methodology has revolved a lot around comprehensible input. How did you develop an interest in comprehensible input, and how have you used it in the classroom?
I came across comprehensible input at my master's program, in my master's program while I was studying at Shida at Huayansuo. Every student of teaching languages as a second language will come across it. It's just a major theory for people who teach in the United States. It's one of the things that is pushed by the major associations, the language teaching associations. So I came across it, I'm sure, in my first couple of years of grad school. And by the second year, I think I was told, I was like, hey, you've got to figure out what your research thesis is going to be on. And I came across CI, and a classmate of mine was like, oh, there's, because I wanted to do a research thesis that was going to help me with teaching in the United States. I didn't want to do it on a grammar point. I didn't want to do it on something really random. When I say random, more like a grammar point that is not going to really be useful in teaching down the line. So a friend, a classmate had said, oh, there's this method I keep hearing about teaching young kids. It's all based on storytelling. Why don't you look into it? So it was called TPRS.
And was this TPRS, this is a version of comprehensible input, so...
I wouldn't call it a version. I would call it a method of teaching that bases its structure on the theory of comprehensible input.
We should mention at this point, in case anyone isn't sure what comprehensible input is, comprehensible input is the theory whose author is Professor Stephen Krashen. The basic idea is that we learn languages through input. We learn languages when we understand messages. And so the role of a language learner is to subject themselves to messages that they understand and to listen and read as much comprehensible and compelling input as possible. So TPRS.
It originally stood for Teaching Proficiency Through Reading and Storytelling. It was developed by a man named Blaine Ray, and he was a Spanish teacher, I think in Colorado, and developed this sort of method and was running workshops and conferences, teaching and training other teachers to use it, mostly Spanish and French. There were a number of Mandarin teachers who got on board with it early on, who were part of these training conferences. So by the time I came around in 2008, 2009, there were a couple of main trainers of this method for Mandarin teachers, one of whom was, her name was Terry Waltz. And I knew she had had a history in Taiwan herself, was from New York State. There was also another woman named Linda Lee, who I had heard about, and an Anik Chen. And these were the three that names I kept coming across. But before that, I was just trying to find out more information about TPRS and CI, and I heard about this, you know, I read about Krashen, and lo and behold, I was talking about Krashen and all of this with a friend in Taiwan. She's also similar to me. She's Hapa. She's mixed. Her father is Taiwanese, and her mother's American. She grew up in the Midwest, and she was like, her father, who was back in Taiwan, was running a educational foundation, and they had brought in Krashen to Taiwan to speak about reading and teaching languages. In that case, it was really for students in Taiwan or children in Taiwan to learn English. And so she invited me to go speak with him after the lecture, and I got to actually meet him. And we had this wonderful conversation both at the event and then later on in the taxi. I'll never forget it. We took him back to the Grand Hotel in Taipei. That was the first time, and he actually gave me some pointers of where to look for information. For my thesis topic, I really wanted to develop curriculum because I wanted to do something that was going to be useful to me. And so my thesis was on K to 5 curriculum design for using TPRS as the main mode of teaching. I scoured for everything to find anything that could help me. So I ended up coming across many of these Mandarin teachers who were starting to use CI or who are now training in them, just sort of grew from there.
Can you give us an idea what a typical introductory class or what a typical class might look like, which involved TPRS, and how that would differ from more conventional classes?
Well, I think when I finally got to actually sit in these training programs, these TPRS training workshops and conferences, it actually blew my mind, because when I was actually doing my thesis research, I didn't get a chance to do any of these training. Back then, there was just nothing available to me in Taiwan, and I didn't have the money or the funds to go back to the United States during the summer to attend them. And so I first stepped into some of these conferences and I was doing the training. It wowed me because I realized that I actually could acquire other languages, because you would go into these conferences and you'd actually take a language class, and it would be something that you had never taken before. So in my case, I think I was in a German class. And then I had to apply it and try it myself with Chinese. And it was really hard. It was really, really hard. I was teaching other language teachers Chinese, but I could see how it was so useful and how it was so effective. Even though I was fumbling, I could see just how effective it was, because I knew from my own experiences how I was taught wasn't going to work with middle school students in America. I think I realized that the slowness of it, what felt to the teacher like it was really going very, very super slow, was actually the key critical moment in how I acquired the little German I did at the first conference I went to, and how long it takes the brain to process that language, that meaning, that comprehension. And it dawned on me that when I was going to teach, I was going to have to learn how to be slow in the classroom. And even now, doing the little teaching that I'm doing with adults at this point, I realize just you can't go fast. That slowness is really, really important. And I think a lot of native speaking teachers forget that. They don't take language classes themselves. And when they don't realize how important it is to go slow.
Something that's central to Stephen Krashen and the way he talks about comprehensible input is that it has to be compelling as well as comprehensible. So I guess the speed would relate to the comprehensible aspect, because it's difficult for people who are just starting out learning Chinese to understand anything, especially if it's fast. So slowing it down would certainly help with that. But in terms of making it compelling, how would you go about doing that?
That's where, and I didn't learn this right away, this came about later on. What I realized, though, was that the cultural differences between the native-speaking Mandarin teachers and the Western students, that cultural gap is actually a huge problem with TPRS, because I think with TPRS or with CI, with compelling input, you have to understand your audience. It's like any show, right? Or a comedian doing stand-up. You got to know your audience, right? Who are you playing to? So to make it compelling, it has to be really about them. So I realized that early on, that when it's not compelling, when it's not about something I'm interested in, it's much harder to keep focus. So for example, when I finally stepped into the classroom, I had been given the piece of advice of to survey my students on their own interests. So one of the first things I did in those first couple of days of class wasn't just to establish classroom management, which is also very important in the K-12 setting, but it was to take a survey. I'd have students do a survey. I was like, tell me, what do you do over the summer? With the younger ones, what's your favorite color? What's a really like fun TV show you watched as a kid? And what's something that you watch now as a middle school student? So getting that survey helped me make things more compelling, because I was able to throw things in randomly. Like, I had one student who was a skier. She really loved skiing. She actually left the school early, a year early, to become a competitive skier. And so normally I wouldn't bring skiing into my classroom. Like, it's something that would come later on, but I wanted to keep her attention. And I knew other students actually did enjoy skiing as well. So I just threw that out there within the first couple of months of class, because I knew that was of interest. Keeping your ear to the ground on what they're interested in is really important. That's the compelling component, is what's interesting to them. It could be boring to you. I got to be honest. You know, they were really into Minecraft, and there was another game that was really popular at the time. But I remember them talking about it right before a spring break. And I happened to go, you know, I don't have a lot of younger cousins or family members. I have a few, very few, but it happened that I was going to a family thing. And I had these cousins of mine who were still luckily in high school at the time. And I said to them, I said, can you tell me more about this game? And they started to explain the game to me. So when I went back after break and I threw those words, and some of the words were in English, but I would use the language, the Mandarin, to talk about this. They were like, oh my God, John Lao sure knows about this. I could see on the look on their faces, like, oh, she's interested in us. So that's the compelling aspect of what Krashen is talking about. You really, and again, you have to know your students. You have to survey them. I don't think I could teach a class where I didn't know anything about my students. That's really hard. You have to quickly get to know them.
One of the things that we've talked about on this podcast quite a lot is pronunciation and tones, and particularly with respect to the comprehensible and compelling input. We did an episode where we discussed Stephen Krashen and his ideas. One of the things that came up is that whilst comprehensible input is definitely extremely useful as a tool for both for teaching and learning, and is kind of central to the way I've learned Chinese and most other people that I know have been successful at learning Chinese, one thing that's come up time and time again is pronunciation and tones, and the fact that comprehensible input possibly doesn't provide the solution, and that there's some training that's necessary as well. I'm wondering if you can tell us how you go about teaching tones.
So really, I don't. I am in sort of the, what I discovered through my experience was, as a teacher, I threw a lot of input at the very beginning, and I didn't correct anyone. If they wanted to say something, I would not force them. What basically I did at the beginning was, there were a lot of yes, no questions, and they could nod their head. There were a lot of questions where, like, for example, I'd be like, 你要吃汉堡还是 BLT? So they had to actually say, and I wouldn't even say 汉堡 at the beginning, maybe. I would say papaya dog. It's a specialty hot dog here in New York. Say, 你要吃 papaya dog 还是 BLT? So they would have to actually say the word BLT or papaya dog. But the input going in is Mandarin. It's looking at the structure, right, of the language, the bones of the language. That's what I want them to focus on. They think I'm asking them about, you know, some sort of food that they're interested in. And that was the way to lower the affective filter. The affective filter is the filter that we all have that makes us conscious of our mistakes, particularly in languages. So as you get older, children, toddlers, elementary school children, their affective filter is quite low because they're just soaking it all in. But once you hit 11, 12 years old, your affective filter is much more sensitive. And you see this with high school kids, with adults. They're like nervous, like, oh my God, I'm thinking about how I'm going to respond. That's the affective filter. So when I'm asking a question that's yes or no, or adding what they call code switching, using the English word for whatever item I'm talking about, I'm lowering their affective filter so that they can actually concentrate on the meaning of the structure that I'm looking at, which is really yao bu yao or chi, right? In that example sentence I gave you. And so when it comes to tones and pronunciation, the only thing that I would use is I would have up on the board the pinyin of the structure that I'm looking at. I'm really looking at for them to acquire this specific structure. In this case, yao chi, right? So when I would have yao and chi up in pinyin, I saw how Terry Waltz was using her TOP method, which is tonally orthographic pinyin, which is that she used both colors and capitalization to show tones. And I would actually have the colors, those markers, those dry erase markers up, and I would quickly, either I would have them up already or have them up on a board. The main structures I'd always be circling. There's another concept called the Super Seven. I don't know if I've mentioned this before. The sort of seven, or in Spanish, I think, in some languages, it's eight structures that are absolutely critical to the communication. So for example, yao in Mandarin is one of them. Yao bu yao, right? And so I'd be pointing to yao and I'd have the pinyin up in that method. In the case of yao, it's fourth tone, right? So Y would be capitalized. A and O wouldn't be capitalized. It would be in red because red is falling tone. And the tone mark would be on the A. And then I would have an equal sign and I would write once. So I'd actually wouldn't even be pointing to the pinyin. I'd be pointing to the English meaning. And I would never actually say the tone. I would never say this is fourth tone. I never actually, pretty much any of my beginner level middle school students, I don't think I ever even explained tones in the first couple of weeks.
And do they all, when they start speaking, do they all produce them?
Not at the beginning. Because I wouldn't actually have them say yao. And then eventually I'd say, oh, 你要吃不吃汉堡? When I knew that they were comfortable with saying yao, I'd have them say yao. Sometimes if I heard a lot of them not kind of expressing or using the right tone, I would like say, okay, quick break with me. 1, 2, 3, yao. And I would like have them like kind of scream it so that they would say it in a falling tone. I do that more for them to get a feel and a brain break. It was a sort of a break from what we were doing, from circling. I didn't necessarily always just do it for the tone. Eventually, when they would say more of a sentence or whatnot, if they said, oh, yao, I'd say, oh, 对, yao, 你要, and whatever they wanted. And so I was correcting them, but not in a way that they knew consciously. And eventually, after a couple of months, even in those first year students, they would self-correct. I would see it. I would see, like, they'd be like, oh yeah, yao, 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 yao hanbao. I noticed how effective and efficient it was because I basically didn't have to do any tone training or pronunciation training. Definitely pronunciation was actually, I think between the two, pronunciation was actually more challenging for my students than tones. And what was challenging? C-A-I, cai. I got a lot of cai. And I just said, oh, right, cai, qing cai, or whatever, mei guo cai, right? And I would just, particularly if I had more than one student doing that, I would just throw it in all the time in whatever I was talking about. Or I would use it as the comparison, whatever sentence structure we were looking at, whatever word specifically that I was, particularly the Super Seven words, which word I was circling. And that took longer, I think, for them to acquire. But I never outright told them that they were doing it wrong. I never gave them that kind of feedback. I would just say it correctly. And I would say, you know, again, in the K-12 setting, the other issue that you have, in at least in Western schools, is that you don't have that much time with the students. Between the schedule, I mean, and this happened especially at the second school I was at, we had these weird schedules where some weeks I would only see them once. Some weeks I would see them three times. So I started to count the hours. By my third year, the final year I was at that second school, I believe I had 90 contact hours with them for the whole year. That's not a lot. And what's more is that we'd have long weekends. We'd have the schedule where I would have them on a Friday, but then I wouldn't have them on until the next Thursday. So almost a week would go by. So that's the other, I think that's the one of the bigger challenges, I think, in the K-12 setting, often for teachers, is the lack of consistency in the schedule. Whereas at the university level, you have students who are there, they'll be there Monday, Tuesday, or Monday, Wednesday, you know, every week for the semester. So I understand now why Zhao Lao Shi wanted us to be at that language lab every single day, because he wanted us to get that input and practice. So that's the challenge, actually, I think, in the K-12 setting, is the consistency. And especially the younger you go, the more exposure and consistent exposure you need to give them.
I'm wondering, just before we finish, are there any particular books or are there any particular materials out there that you would recommend people read, have a look at if they're interested in exploring TPRS and comprehensible input more?
The Bible is Terry Waltz's phenomenal book. I think it's wonderful. It's called TPRS with Chinese Characteristics. And she really articulately and very clearly describes how to incorporate and use CI TPRS in teaching Mandarin and why. And why it's so effective and efficient. It's available on Kindle. She has actually a bilingual version. And there is, I believe, Chinese version, simplified and traditional, available. And that is by far and away, I think, one of the best books to read as a starter if you want to understand TPRS. I think the other thing I want to make clear, is CI is the sort of theory. And TPRS is actually only one of the methods that is CI-based. I use TPRS because that is one of the major methods, but it's not the only method that I would use in my classroom. It was the basis of my teaching, but I definitely did other things in the class. But all of it is under the umbrella of CI. It was always to drive the input for acquisition.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much, Pamela, for joining us on today's podcast and for sharing all your really interesting experiences, both as a learner and as a teacher. And hopefully we'll have you back sometime.
Yes, I enjoyed this immensely. Thank you for having me on.
Hey there, thanks for listening to this episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. If you're currently looking to improve your Mandarin speaking skills, you might like to check out my Peak Mandarin newsletter. Run by me and my friend Will Hart, we share exactly what you need to do to become fluent in Chinese based on our experience. Subscribe to the newsletter and we'll also send you a free copy of my ebook, Lessons from a Chinese Learning Phenomenon, which tells the story of exactly how Will Hart learned to speak near native level Chinese within a 1.5 year period, how I put his techniques into practice to become fluent myself, and how you can too. To subscribe to the newsletter, you can go to peakmandarin.com or click the link in the description. That's all for now. Until next episode, goodbye.